Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Welcome to a very special episode of Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson, and joining me, who's joining me? Who is that? Who's over there?
Vanity Fair correspondent Anthony Bresnikan.
Our man in the outer rim, Anthony Bresnikan. Anthony and I are here to talk, by popular demand. Honestly, I had no idea that people wanted us to talk about this as much as they did. But
it's so nice. It's so nice to know that people wanted to hear our thoughts, and we're really living up to the title of this program. We're still watching. You just haven't been hearing from us.
Yeah, so we are going to talk about The Mandalorian this week on Still Watching, and Anthony and I are going to record one more after the finale, after it's all wrapped up. There's only two more episodes of the season, but we today are just going to talk up through Chapter 14, which is Season 2, Episode 6, titled The Tragedy. We are not talking about anything in the future because we have not seen anything in the future, so there's no spoilers coming from us. Though they may exist out in the internet, and we will just be talking about the episode that aired this Friday morning. Anthony and I did, if you missed it, last year we did an episode for every episode of The Mandalorian.
We had interviews with the talent and the filmmakers. It was a bonanza.
It was a whole thing. but Lucasfilm, their approach to The Mandalorian, and it has paid off for them, has been to keep everything very secret and controlled and locked down. And this year they decided to go even more locked down than before. So in the theme of the lockdown year of 2020, Mando season 2 was super locked down. So it didn't really make a lot of sense for us to do a podcast episode for every episode of the show. But we were lucky enough at Vanity Fair to get one of those precious kernels of inside information. Anthony Bresnikan, who did you get to talk to about this season of The Mandalorian?
Yeah. So last week, after the Ahsoka Tano episode, The Jedi, I spoke with Rosario Dawson, who plays this beloved character who's existed for years and years in animation, performed by Ashley Eckstein, and now in live action and in middle age, I suppose you'd say, since she's in her 40s, Ahsoka Tano. Although who knows how long a Togruta lives. She might still be in...
Oh, good point.
...in the spring of... of a Togruta's life.
What is the lifespan of a Togruta? Please do email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Yeah, so Anthony and I are here to talk about The Mandalorian. Please do read that interview that he did with Rosario. It's so good. He also chatted with Dave Filoni for that interview. It's a great, great article. One of the best and most in-depth I've read about. No, the most in-depth that I've read about this season of The Mandalorian. So, and Filoni gives some extra added insights, which is really great. And also, if you're in the mood to learn more about Ahsoka Tano, who was obviously this big showcase of the middle of the season, Anthony did a great oral history on Ahsoka Tano that ran earlier this year on Vanity Fair. So just Google Ahsoka Tano, Anthony Bresnikan, and you should be all set to go.
Oh, wait. No. See, I thought you were gonna mention your story about Ahsoka Tano, which this is super mutual admiration society here. But I was going to say it was just a beautiful and profound write-up also full of spectacular gifts. You are quite, you're like throwing these gifts out like little ninja throwing stars of Ahsoka and her history and the rich meaning she has for all Star Wars fans, but especially for women, I think, who find special value in her and her journey and her story. So Google Joanna Robinson and find her Ahsoka story, her recent Ahsoka story that came out just as a little teaser, as I hate to say appetizer, because it was a solid, significant piece. It was a nice setup for who Ahsoka is, especially if you're like watching this show and you're like, who is that? Because not everybody watches all things Star Wars. There are some people who are, you know, casual, easygoing fans, and they are completists. And for those who haven't watched the Clone Wars and Rebels, I think Joe's story is a really excellent and thrilling and fun and beautiful ride through Ahsoka's journey.
Thank you. It's essentially a previously on Ahsoka Tano. Yes. you can read that over on VF.com. You know, we've been doing weekly recaps. We didn't do one this week because, frankly, you know what? We decided to do a podcast instead. So that is what we're here to do. We're going to talk about the first six episodes of this season. And some folks were kindly sent me some questions over on Twitter. We're just going to dig into how we think the show is going so far. Is it evolving? Is it stagnating? You know, I'm personally enjoying having this little treat on a Friday morning or really late Thursday night, the end of my work week. But some of the questions we got were folks expressing maybe some eagerness for the show to expand beyond its original premise, which they feel maybe that's sort of where it's sitting. But before we get to that, I wanted to start by asking you, Anthony, something you and I have talked, I mean, we talk a lot about the show off air.
We basically do a podcast every week. It's just as a broadcast.
It's just a phone call. But like something that you and I have talked about, and you talked to Dave about this a couple times, is this idea, like, I like that you mentioned that there are plenty of people who are watching The Mandalorian and maybe have seen every Star Wars film, multiple times, but there is definitely a subset of Star Wars fan that has only watched live action Star Wars, Mandalorian, mm-hmm. and the films. The animated series are very popular, and there's a whole generation of kids who grew up with, like, this is their Star Wars, is Clone Wars and Rebels. But there's also, you know, people who just didn't think that the animated series was for them. But I wanted to talk to you about this idea of was it before this, The Force Awakens, Lucasfilm made a decision about canon and what was canon and what wasn't? Because for years and years, mm-hmm. and years, there were expansion novels. There was all this sort of like lore that was out there. And Lucasfilm decided to like tighten up and just be like, okay, we're going to narrow down what counts as canon, what counts as legends. So can you clarify for folks listening sort of where that dividing line happened and where we are with that?
Yeah, basically, I mean, I'm not sure what they've recanonized. Like, the line has gotten a little blurrier over the years, partly because of Dave Filoni, who really, through Rebels, brought back a lot of things that had been unpersoned, you know? And I think it was it's a complicated answer, but there's this line that Yoda says in The Clone Wars, and I think it's echoed by Ahsoka, where legends always have a little bit of truth to them. And they call this decanonized storytelling legends. And what Dave has done is bring back a little bit of truth to it, bring it into Rebels, and therefore sort of reactivate it, you know? I think basically everything that wasn't on screen before the Disney acquisition of Lucasfilm has essentially been eradicated from the mm-hmm. canon. Or like, right. Basically, that's just a story. That's just a legend. If I'm wrong about them keeping this piece or that piece, Forgive me. It's a big, vast galaxy.
You're not wrong, because what you've already said is that they're like, they've legendized all that stuff, but they're cherry picking through what they've decided to reconstitute as canon, yeah. Right?
And even little things, like there were these great Lando Calrissian novels from back in the 80s, I want to say. Not even the 90s, but like the mid-early 80s. And in Solo, Lando, when they're doing the mine invasion, Lando's hanging back at the Millennium Falcon, and he's dictating his memoirs. And so the thing that Donald Glover is saying is like taken from one of these novels. So like it's like little things like that. Even the early stuff, they've brought it back in ways. But then in the 90s, starting with these Timothy Zahn novels called the Thrawn Trilogy, that was really the continuation of Star Wars, when there was no hope of Star Wars movies in the future. This was Luke and Han and Leia after the events of Return of the Jedi, cleaning up the galaxy, reestablishing order, and this blue-skinned Imperial officer named Grand Admiral Thrawn was trying to essentially create like the First Order. They didn't use that term, and he had this I hate to say Smurf blue. It's even more radiant than that skin.
Oh, yeah.
He had these bright blue eyes, and we know that from the cover of the novels. But like, most of it was in our imagination.
It's like Violet Beauregard blue.
Yes, very much. Yeah, precisely. And you know, those novels were among the things that were like, okay, that didn't really happen. And I think that was necessary in order to carve a new path with the new films and determine what happened to Luke, what happened to Han, what happened to Leia, what happened to their descendants. And you don't want to hamstring filmmakers by saying, by the way, here are 30 books and short stories that you're going to have to tie into.
Right.
And so, yeah, so a lot of it's been, I would say, like, it's considered like, now maybe a first draft that's been put on the shelf, but then sometimes you pull things from those first drafts and put it in the new drafts of stories.
Yeah, so, you know, all that's to say that something I think that Dave Filoni has done, and once again, if you want to know more about Dave Filoni, I think people are, you know, people who haven't been following his career closely through the animated Star Wars are really, I think, starting to know his name better and better through The Mandalorian. But if you want to learn more, Anthony's got some great stuff on Dave Filoni on VF.com. But this idea, something that Dave Filoni has done with the animated shows and now with Mandalorian in concert with Jon Favreau, is really try to build a net around all the things that they're considering canon and making it feel coherent and everything feel important and valuable. And so something that I talked about a bit in that Ahsoka Tano thing that I wrote was how the Clone Wars is so focused on helping us better understand Anakin Skywalker, the good that was Anakin Skywalker, and so the loss of Anakin Skywalker. And Ahsoka Tano is very instrumental to that because she was his Padawan. And so, like, loving her and him loving her helped us love him. Even if, you know, plenty of people love the prequel trilogy, but even if the prequel trilogy doesn't work for you and Hayden Christensen's Anakin Skywalker, I don't think it's Hayden's fault. I think it's just like, maybe we didn't get enough time with him. I don't know what it was. But like, for plenty of people, that fall of Anakin Skywalker did not land the way that I think George Lucas really wanted it to. And Clone Wars goes back in and fills in the time between the second and third movie of the prequel trilogy and helps you understand what we lost with Anakin Skywalker. And I think that's so smart. It's so smart to do that. Mm-hmm. And you know, The Mandalorian is doing something kind of similar in the gap between the original trilogy and the sequel trilogy. Not that it was set out to do that, because this was already in the works before some of the wheels started to fall off of the sequel trilogy for some people. But if you watch the sequel trilogy and love The Force Awakens, there was a division around The Last Jedi. I think it's a perfect film, but that's okay. And then The Rise of Skywalker didn't work for a lot of people as well. If it feels like the Mandalorian is trying to reach forward and, you know, pull some of that stuff. We saw what we think is like some Snoke in tubs, and and make it part, make stuff that maybe didn't work as well for us, maybe the Palpatine thing, maybe all of that, and make it part of this story that is working for us, and reach back and make some of the stuff that happened in the past, you know, part of the story and work for us, and just basically shore up the shakier parts of the Star Wars legend, not to put too, all wrapped up in a very simplistic story about a dad and his little green son, you know?
Yes. I love that Star Wars is kind of has been doing this. One of my favorite examples is from one of the recent novels, at least in recent years. I think it was 2016's Bloodlines by Claudia Gray. And I think you and I have spoken about this before, but I think she's one of the best Star Wars writers out there, you know, working in novels and short stories. And that story was about middle-aged Leia, like after the fall of the Empire, set many years after, and she's, you know, older, she's leading the Republic, the New Republic, and nobody really knows that she's the descendant of Darth Vader, you know, which would be like this big political scandal, you know. And there's a scene in that that Claudia wrote that where she's talking to one of her, I think one of her guards or protectors, one of the main other main characters in the story. And they're talking about, oh, we heard that you used to like mock Grand Moff Tarkin by imitating his British accent. And that explains the one scene in the original Star Wars where for some reason Leia has a British accent.
That's funny. That's,
you know, like it's just sort of like retconning this thing that's just an obvious error. Yeah. And even like the, you know, the gold bikini, which I think is now considered problematic, and it was really, you know, well liked by a lot of people for a long time. But the term for that was Slave Leia, which is an even more problematic thing to say these days, in particular. And it that renamed her actions there as the Hutt Slayer outfit.
And like, I love that.
It's like, instead of it being, you know, a bit of exploitation, which I think it kind of was, it was like, oh, she, you know, she went undercover and she was this Hutt Slayer outfit. So
yeah, I mean, I still have my issues with gold bikini, but I love Hutt Slayer as a as a term, as a concept. I think that's freaking great. Yeah. But yeah, the thing that I was comparing all of this, And we are going to get into specifics of the Mandalorian. I just thought it was interesting to set the stage a little bit first. Is like something, my favorite example of like what I think they're doing really well here comes from another franchise, which is the MCU. And I know I've talked to you about this before, but this idea that like what Endgame did, spoilers for the MCU, what Endgame did, Endgame, which I like to think of as a series finale for the Avengers, in using time travel. And using and hopping back through its own franchise is making even some of its weaker links, like Thor: The Dark World, suddenly incredibly important. I mean, that's one of the smartest things the MCU did, is send Thor back in time to the events of Thor: The Dark World, and suddenly like that movie, which is considered one of the weakest MCU movies, is important to the end game of everything. Ooh. And so then when people are like, because people ask me all the time, like, oh, how should I watch the MCU movies, or are there any I can skip? And maybe I used to say like, oh, you can skip the Thor: The Dark World, and now you don't feel like you can say that.
No.
And similarly with Clone Wars and Rebels, you know, to dust off an old phrase from the NBC lineup, everything becomes must-see TV when Ahsoka Tano shows up, played by Rosario Dawson. And immediately a bunch of people who haven't watched the animated series are like, who's this and why is everyone losing their mind over her? And then people are like, you gotta watch Clone Wars, and you should also watch Rebels while you're at it. And I've seen just an increasing amount of articles and the like that are saying like, these are the essential Clone Wars episodes to watch, or these are the essential Rebels episodes to watch. And that was already true just by dint of the fact that we're talking about Mandalorians, we're talking about the Darksaber, Bo-Katan is here, you know, but when Ahsoka Tano shows up, it really just feels like, hey, you got to go back and do your research. Dave Filoni's like, sorry, everything I did is essential, man. You got to go back and watch it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's, and I have no problem with it. I'm just wondering if it lands that way for you as well.
It totally does. Yeah. It's like, I mean, I don't think every episode is necessary, but there are so many important runs, everything from Bo-Katan, who we saw Katie Sackhoff bring to life in live action. She also performed the voice of that Mandalorian warrior. You know, there are runs of the story that I think are really important. I also think it's going to be increasingly important as we get an Obi-Wan series to know exactly who he was during the Clone Wars. I think that was his pivotal moment. And he was a supporting player in the original trilogy and a mentor and the wise old man. But this is how he became that. And so I think all of that is, yeah, it's essential viewing.
All right. So let us talk about this season so far. What is the episode that has happened so far this season? So we've had the Marshal, the Passenger, the Heiress, the Siege, the Jedi, the Tragedy is the latest one. Is there one that stands out to you as this is what I want the Mandalorian to be? This is the Mandalorian at its best.
I would say Passenger for me and the Jedi. I really like the Jedi. I know some people didn't, or they didn't like Ahsoka's look, or they had issues with the direction. I liked the slower pace of it. I liked that it was weirder. It had a stranger vibe. I think Star Wars is best when it's weird. Kind of like Guardians of the Galaxy weird, where it has a little bit of a sense of humor about itself. The Passenger had that for me. The fact that she was just called Frog Lady and never really given anything beyond that, like that reminded me of the old Walrus Man and Squid Face and, you know, Snaggletooth nicknames that they used to give the creatures that kind of stuck before they had the complicated, like, Star Wars names in canon. I thought both of those were standouts, and I loved seeing Ahsoka come to life. I think she's such an interesting person and character and fighter. She's so vulnerable in some ways because she has a very big heart. She's not a blue steel kind of hero. Her power is that she cares a lot. And I love the way Rosario performed her. And I thought that was an interesting fusion of the Western with the samurai film, which both influenced each other in lots of ways in cinema history. And they're coming together now in this sci-fi story. And those were some of my favorites. How about you, Joe?
I it's funny you mentioned that about the Jedi. I knew that, like, obviously because of conversations you've had with Dave and you know, my own, film literacy, whatever it's worth, I knew that there was huge samurai influences in the Jedi. But then a friend of mine, I was just scrolling back through his Twitter, and he made this video that didn't get a lot of traction, because he's not, like, this isn't what he does for a living. He just, like, sort of did it for fun, where he did a side-by-side, and maybe someone else has done this too, but he did a side-by-side shot comparison of some things from the Jedi and Yojimbo. And it, shot for shot, some moments. And I just thought, I didn't realize it was that detailed, and it was pretty incredible. And what's funny about those shots in Yojimbo is you do see these strong gusts of smoky wind blow through Yojimbo, sort of buffering against our hero. And I thought it was so interesting when you talked to Dave Filoni that his inspiration for the look of that episode was, like, the burned out, Northern California fire landscape. And that hits really hard for me, for all of us who live in California, for me who lives up here near Dave Filoni. I don't know. I found that really emotional and then really visually striking for that episode. And then this week's episode, Tragedy. I know a lot of Southern California folks are like, oh, hey, that looks like many a foothill near where I live in Southern California. So, you know, these you know, we're used to these exotic desert jungle planets or whatever. But right now mm-hmm. we're getting a lot of California planets, and that's okay.
This very much looked like where I grew up, or where I live. Yeah, where I grew up, where yeah. I live right now. Santa Clarita has a lot of rocky hillsides like that that have like the green tufts growing between the exposed rocks. So it looked very familiar. Very MASH.
For me, for me.
Can I rewind just for a moment?
Because, of
course. You know, for that Rosario de Filoni story, I'll have to check and see what was actually published. But, like, I spoke to him for an hour, so there was a lot of stuff that didn't make the cut. And you mentioning the comparison to Yojimbo reminded me that he cited that film specifically. So I guess that's, as long as you cite your source, it's not copying. It's homage.
I did not mean it as like copying at all.
No, but he said a lot of what I did is an homage to the fact that my dad had me watching Kurosawa films when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking 7, 8 years old watching Seven Samurai and Yojimbo. You don't appreciate it as much then, but you watch it over the years and you're like, this is amazing and remarkable how well it translates and holds up. And Star Wars at its foundation is an expression of George's love of cinema as much as anything else. So we try to keep that tie in there, too. So
I love that. That's a nice thing. Yeah, and I mean, like, in season one, the episode The Sanctuary, you know, a lot of folks pointed out that it owed a lot to The Magnificent Seven, The Seven Samurai, that beautiful blend of samurai and Western that exists in that story. And, you know, Star Wars and, you know, at its heart is an homage to samurai and Western storytelling. So
definitely a pastiche of all sorts of different types of mythology.
But my favorite part of the Jedi, beyond sort of some of the conversations between Rosario Dawson's character and Pedro Pascal's character, is that cut back and forth between, you know, you I watched the episode a little after you did on that Friday, and you told me that Michael Biehn was in the episode, and I was like, oh, so that before watching the episode, I was like, oh, so Pedro Pascal can have someone to fight while Rosario Dawson is fighting someone else. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because, like, usually that's what happens when you've got two ace fighters, is you want them equally preoccupied in the final fight, right? And what I love about the juxtaposition of those two fights is you've got a gunslinger fight in the street between the Mandalorian and this character played by Michael Biehn. Michael Biehn, who I know best from a lot of his sci-fi work, but a lot of, you know, he's also in Tombstone, obviously, so he's done the gunslinger thing. And I also saw, like, a shot-by-shot comparison of, like, some of the moves that he does in Tombstone versus, like, what they're doing, this sort of blaster square-off showdown that they have in the street. And then in the garden in that episode, you've got a very classic samurai fight. And cutting back and forth between those two, I just thought was incredibly beautiful, just really, really beautiful filmmaking.
Yeah, I think so too.
So from, like, a filmmaking point of view, and Dave Filoni wrote and directed that episode of The Jedi, from a filmmaking point of view, I think The Jedi is a real level up for the series from, like, me just having a great time with this Friday morning serial that we watch. It's The Marshall, the first one. And that's partially because I'm a huge Timothy Oliphant fan, but, like, I just, I really loved his addition to the series of Cobb Vanth. I loved the Krayt Dragon. I loved all of it. I thought that one was a really fun episode. So, like, fun with The Marshall, and then just, like, eerie and emotional and just really soulful stuff in The Jedi.
And it had a Tremors homage, so that's worth mentioning.
I love Tremors so much, it's true. Anyway, so that's the season so far. I think you and I were a little mixed on this latest episode. Do you want to talk about your sort of, like, your broader feelings about the tragedy?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the tragedy part is. Like, is
the loss of the child?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's taken.
He's taken.
Like, is it that the race? Like, I wouldn't call it, like, is that a tragedy? Like I would say, like, the kidnapping or something. I don't know. Like, the tragedy. I thought, oh my God, are they going to kill Baby Yoda now that we've learned something about Baby Grogu? Excuse me. but It's interesting for a show that had, for an episode that had so many, like, cataclysmic revelations that Boba Fett is alive, although we kind of guessed that from seeing Temuera Morrison appear in the first episode of this season, to seeing my favorite Fennec Shand come back, Ming-Na Wen, now yes. with, like, a... with, like, a cyborg belly where she was shot.
A cyborg belly and a fun orange helmet that makes it easier to swap in a stunt performer for her. Mm-hmm. I love that helmet, though. I was like, I saw the helmet. I was like, I love this. Cosplayers are going to have a really good time with this. And also, it's going to make it really easy when I presume she's about to do a bunch of flips, which she did, which mm-hmm. is great. So
orange is Fennec's color. Like, what's Fennec the Fox, right?
So oh,
orange streak. Like, even on the original, her original appearance last season, she had these orange threads woven in through her very complicated braid. I really like that character. And
same.
I hope we see more of her. And I like Boba Fett. I always did. I know everybody says he was a chump back in the day, that he never, well, that he looked cool but didn't do anything cool. He was sleek. He was smart. And, you know, he had a small role to play, but an important one. And now maybe he'll get a little bit more. I don't think his armor fit too well, though.
Well, okay. So let's talk about this. Okay. So oftentimes when I hear you talk about The Mandalorian, and I hear other guys your age, and I am very good friends with a lot of these guys, mm-hmm. I hear you guys talk about The Mandalorian as if it's made specifically for you, not in an exclusive way, but just sort of like, oh my god, this feels just made just for me. I used to play with these toys, blah, blah, blah. And Mike Ryan, you know, who knows a plenty about Star Wars, made this observation about how old Jon Favreau is, what exactly which toys he would have been playing with, and why we're seeing a lot of those characters recur even in the background in The Mandalorian, because this is the stuff of Jon Favreau's childhood, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, Star Wars, for a long time, by less evolved fans, was considered very, like, white and male and bro, and there are ways in which I really push back on that, and I've heard you push back on it and mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff, and Lucasfilm itself is trying to say, like, no, Star Wars is for everyone. All that being said, when I watched this episode, which I did like, I was like, okay, but this episode is for the people who bought the Boba Fett action figure before mm-hmm. Boba Fett appeared in the original trilogy, because they thought he looked really cool, and then he showed up and he didn't do as much as they wanted. And that's the whole story of Boba Fett, is that he wasn't as cool as everyone wanted him to be. And then I thought he got to be tremendously cool in this episode. And I was like, like 30 years later, the kids who bought that action figure got their cool, cool Boba Fett moment, you know?
Well, I think you're absolutely spot on with all of those points. And I will say, you know, as a dad now, as sharing playtime with my kids, I have a son who's 7 and loves Star Wars, and he loves Transformers, and he loves Ninjago and thing. He has his own stuff too. But, like, a lot of these toys transcend generations now. And one of the things I've noticed is little kids, they love to play. They love to make up stories. They're not great at creating characters. I think it's maybe just the empathy it takes to create different types of characters. It requires a little more growing up, you know?
Yeah.
And what Star Wars and what, you know, I think My Little Pony and what Care Bears and what other toy lines do is they give you the characters and they tell you what makes them different from each other. And then you make up your story and in ways learn empathy that way and learn, you know, who the traitorous character is, who the downbeat character is, who the upbeat character is. And I think guys like Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni, guys like me, women like you, we learn to tell stories by playing with the toys. And I think what you're seeing now is that manifestation on screen is a lot of the things that they grew up, they learned storytelling. And this one reason I think a lot of fans care so much about Star Wars is because they were active participants in the creation of Star Wars. They learned storytelling by telling stories with their toys. And so now when you see that transporter that Cara Dune drove off the cliff and, you know, was driving through the canyon, that was just a toy. That was never in any of the movies, but it was a legitimate Kenner toy back in the day.
Right.
And it's been, again, that's one of those re-canonized things that they put into the show. A couple years ago on Rebels, they stole some TIE fighters, and the Empire pushed a button, like a self-destruct button, that made the foils on the TIE fighter pop off so they couldn't escape.
Uh-huh.
And that was a fixture built in to the actual toys, because you know how they are, how they're structured. If you push that too far, they would instantly break. So to prevent kids from instantly breaking their toys, they made them like any amount of pressure causes them just to spring off. they built that into the show. So I think like kids learn storytelling through their toys, and that's what we're seeing in The Mandalorian. It's like a toy adventure in the backyard come to life, right down to the characters shooting at each other from little rocky outcropping.
Well, it's funny. I was watching the reaction to this episode, and I figured, you know, people would be really excited to see Boba Fett. Yes, a little thicker in his middle age, but like getting to like crack open stormtroopers like they were eggs with his like various weapons. I thought his stuff was incredible. And I thought Fennec Shand was incredible. Like I thought like that gunfight, and we should say this episode is directed by Robert Rodriguez, who knows his way around a gunfight. Mm-hmm. That fight on the hill was a little long for my taste, but there are moments where I was just like, I gasped. I was like, oh, this is so great. But what's funny is when I was looking at people's reactions, they were some people were as excited about Boba Fett as they were about Slave One, his ship. And like you talking about, you know, kids and their toys and all of that helps me understand why Star Wars fans know the names of all the ships that are in Star Wars, which I don't. I did not play with Star Wars toys as a kid. Like I watched the movies obsessively. I did not play with the toys. Like I had my army of Barbies. That was what I did. But like, but if Barbie had a spaceship, I would probably know the name of it. So, you know, like people being really excited about these ships, about the designation of the ships and being able to identify them makes sense if they have like an emotional connection to a toy that they had as a kid. That's really fun to think about.
There's an aspect of Boba Fett that I really liked in this is that he's terrifying. He's got a burned face. Like, obviously, I think that we can imply, we don't know what all, we never saw him without the helmet in the original show, or in the original movies, but we could presume maybe that was his scarring when he escaped the Sarlacc pit, you know, maybe a little acid scarring, but he's scary looking, and intimidating looking, and he's a little bigger. You know, what I liked when he put the armor on, and it didn't quite fit, was that this is not the same guy that we saw back in the day. I think Temuera Morrison, broader shouldered silhouette and figure, and maybe a little more muscular than Jeremy Bullock was when he played Boba Fett back in the day. But I like that he put it on. It was kind of like Indiana Jones putting on his hat after a big battle with some Nazis in the desert. And like, it's a little tattered and maybe doesn't fit so well anymore, but like, the armor itself was scarred. It's burned. You know, it's burned by acid, and yet it was important to him because his father was important to him, and the fact that his father was a foundling was important to him. So when he puts it on, what I really liked, I'm certainly not making fun of him, but I think what I liked about it not fitting exactly is I thought, oh, are they going to put the armor on, and then it's going to fit perfectly. And he's going to look like the old Boba Fett. This didn't look like the old Boba Fett. This is the new Boba Fett. This is Boba Fett who's been through some things. Literally through the Sarlacc. So I like that. I like that he's changed.
I agree. And I loved the way, you know, we saw his robes sort of, you know, when he initially popped up and in the early part of this episode. I love that he kept the robes on. And so he like has his plated, like, you know, he has the armor plating on his legs, but the robe over it, it looks like it goes together really well. And it gives him this like wilder look to it. Once again, I'm like, I'm always thinking about the cosplayers. It's like the cosplayers are going to have such a fun time. Like I was just thinking of couples cosplaying as like older Boba Fett and Fennec Shand. I was like, that's going to look so cool. So I thought he looked amazing. I thought the weapons that he was using looked amazing and all that.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We're going to talk about him emerging from the Sarlacc pit, actually, but I want to go back really quickly to something you said about his father being a foundling. So my understanding, because my Clone Wars memory is shaky at times, but my understanding is that in the Clone Wars, they tried to say that Jango Fett and Boba Fett were not Mandalorians. And then in this episode, he's saying, no, my father was a foundling and he fought in the Mandalorian Civil War. We are Mandalorians. So what's, you know, which is fine. That all sounds to me like some legends are, you know, there's a truth to some legends and, like, you know, depends on who's telling the story and stuff like that. I think of that less as a retcon and more as like just different angles on the same story. Yeah. But it seemed like a big moment for some folks watching this episode to have Boba and Jango like quote unquote legitimized as Mandalorians.
I kind of think Mandalorian maybe is not so much it's not a genetic designation. It's not a race.
Right, right.
You know, you have people of all different races as Mandalorians. It's an ethos, right? It's like a calling. It's, I don't know if it's, maybe it's like, it's like, a faith, right? And so you don't necessarily have to be born into it.
Which I knew that when we talked about this a lot in season one. But what's interesting is, like, even that has its permutations, as we understand through, like, meeting Boba Katan in this season and stuff like that. It's like, I thought, okay, what defines you as a Mandalorian is the way that Din Djarin keeps talking about. But his way is not everyone's way, and it doesn't make the other people not Mandalorians. So I don't know. It was just funny because I remember when the series is announced and a bunch of people were like, oh my God, this is going to be a Boba Fett series. And Jon Favreau was like, no, I promise the titular Mandalorian is not Boba Fett. And people were like, yeah, you know, fool me twice, whatever. But then a bunch of people came out of the woodwork to be like, actually, Jango Fett and Boba Fett aren't Mandalorians, so they couldn't be the Mandalorian. So I just think this is like a fun, like, well, actually, they are, you know, or, well, actually, the definition of Mandalorian is a little bit more complicated and nebulous. But I like that it fits with that Mandalorian ethos of, which we talked about a lot when we talked about season one, this idea of, like, adoption and caretaking and foundlings and raising. Like, if Grogu is, you know, if he sticks with Din Djarin, which he might not, but if he does, is Grogu a Mandalorian? Is raised, found, and raised by a Mandalorian? Is he a Mandalorian? You know? I don't know. Is he going
to
get a little...
They're going to have to cut some ear holes in that.
Going to get a little helm? I don't know. All right.
Can I say... I don't know if this is any of the filmmakers' intention, but within this story, this particular aspect of the story, what defines a Mandalorian, I see symbolism for what makes a fan. Right.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, you have these, speaking of, you know, bros or whatever, like guys, you know, I don't know if it's just guys, but a lot of the times it is. You know, they love something and they want to make it exclusive to them, right? Like, you're not a true fan.
Right.
You hear this a lot in comics, too. Like, you know, a Thor movie comes out and a woman goes into the comic shop and says, I like that Thor movie. You have any good Thor comics for me? And you think a true fan would say, yes, I'm glad that that intrigued you. Here's, you know, you got to read this classic run and here's this story and here's this character that you might also like. And it's a chance to really play the deep cuts, you know? But instead it's like, oh, well, let me test your knowledge, you know, and ask a bunch of questions. And if you can't answer that, you're not a true fan. And I think women in Star Wars have had to deal with that garbage for a long time. And people various different backgrounds who find a connection to these stories, you know, they get challenged. Like, well, you're not a true fan. If you just came up through the prequels, well, you're not a true fan. If you just came in through, you know, the animated Clone Wars series, you're not a true fan. You're a true fan if you're a true fan. And I think that's one of the things that the Mandalorian identity is really
I love that.
Projecting. Yeah. I mean, what do you think? Like,
yeah.
if you follow the way, if you think the helmet and armor is cool, if you do things, if you believe and care about the same things we do, you're a Mandalorian. Welcome to the party, pal.
It's interesting because I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been trying to, you know, I'm a Star Wars fan, but I'm like, you know, as I said, I didn't have the toys. I didn't read the novels, though my sister did. Like, I'm a primarily like a live action Star Wars fan. And like, so I do get frustrated sometimes when people try to gatekeep, but at the same time, I know there is pleasure in being able to talk about minutiae of something if you spent years and years and years and years sort of drenched in these various extended stories.
What we're doing now is sharing it with people, and like,
exactly.
Hopefully there are people who are like, oh, that's cool, I didn't know that there was a short story about Boba Fett escaping from the Sarlacc pit that, you know, was a legend and now it's canon. But I don't understand this desire to close off something.
No, exactly.
I don't understand it in music. Like, a band gets big and suddenly it's like, well, you didn't listen to them when they were just playing clubs.
I guess that's my point. I think there's like a middle ground. Like, I think gatekeeping is bad on any level. But I was trying to think about it in terms of Game of Thrones. Like, Game of Thrones is the fandom that I probably know the best. And I am not, like, you know, a PhD expert in the writings of George R. R. Martin, but I've read all of his books and I've studied them and I think about them a lot. And I could talk minutia about Game of Thrones in a way that, like, maybe not your average Thrones watcher can, though I certainly get lapped by plenty of other book readers. But so there's pleasure in being able to talk about the minutia with people who also understand the minutia. But I would never say that someone who just watched the show is not a Game of Thrones fan. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's the difference. It's like, you're still a fan, but I still think it's okay. You know, I was thinking about it. Like, I was thinking about some of my friends who like to talk to other people who understand Star Wars on the molecular level, the way that you do. And I was a little like, hey, why don't you want to talk to me? And then I was like, no, I get it. Like, they want to talk to someone who understands, like, all the, like, tiny, tiny character details that I might miss. But they, you know, none of them are awful bros, and they would all, like, share it with me if I asked them about it, you know? So that's sort of the difference, I guess.
Can I tell a little personal story?
Yeah, please.
My wife is a huge comics fan, and she loves Iron Man especially because when she was a little girl, she had heart surgery. And her big brother, Grant, shared his comics with her as she was growing up. And she really loved Tony Stark because he had heart problems. That was his whole thing. He needed the arc reactor to draw the metal away from his heart. I don't know how medically accurate that is, but like, she connected with that. She loves that character. And it's funny because Robert Downey Jr.'s performance reminds her of her brother. Like, he looks a lot like him, same sort of demeanor. And I think, thank God for those big brothers who were willing to share things with their little sisters. And, you know, and even like Katie Sackhoff talking about playing Bo-Katan, like, she did this interview with Entertainment Tonight's Ash Crossan, and the part I found most moving was she was talking about how excited her dad was to see her in the role, because her dad was this huge sci-fi nut who shared all this stuff with her. Star Wars was a thing he shared with her. And, you know, his daughter grew up to be a hero in Battlestar Galactica and in Star Wars. So I think that sharing, to me, enhances your love of something. And what's better than showing your love for a kind of storytelling than sharing it with the people who you may love or who may be strangers to you?
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what you and I do for a living, is to share stories with total strangers and hopefully excite them about the making of it or the story behind it. And you know, that I think that's true fandom.
And my favorite thing to do, like, I don't, it's tough. It's tough sometimes. I don't know how to describe what I do because I'm not a critic, and I don't even think of myself really as an investigative journalist. But what I do, my favorite thing to do, is to give people the context that might help them find better or deeper meaning to something, right?
Yeah.
So something like that Ahsoka Tano thing that I wrote, that's about me just wanting people to be as prepared and excited as they can be for the arrival of that character. Or like, mm-hmm. all the stuff I did around Thrones had to do with that, had to do with like me trying to be like, okay, here's what happens in the books, and this is why this means something even a little deeper than you might be able to catch if you just watch the show, which is like no shame in it, but just sort of like, if you want the deeper meaning, I would love to share it with you.
Okay. We tell the story of the storyteller.
yeah, exactly. All right, so I want to talk about, we're going to get to, people have a couple Jedi-related questions for us, and we're going to get to those, but I want to spend another minute or two on Boba Fett and talk to you about a fun thing that I discovered prepping for this conversation, which is something that our producer, actually, Dave Gonzalez, said to me offhandedly. Is he was like, well, you know, they took the plot that they had for the Boba Fett movie and they used it in the first episode of this season. And I didn't really know what he was talking about, but oftentimes when I don't know what people are talking about, I don't say anything and I just go Google it for myself. And I found that, you know, there's a rumor that a version of the Boba Fett movie that they were planning to do with Josh Trank centered on someone else who had taken the Boba Fett armor. And so, like, that's sort of what Dave was saying. Like, the Timothy Olyphant character, Cobb Vanth, who has taken Boba Fett's armor, is, you know, is not Boba Fett, but is Boba Fett at the same time. But what's fun is that I was reading something and they were like, EW reported, and I was like, oh, I know if I click on this link, it's going to be Anthony Brezikin byline, and it was, where you actually broke the news about another, at least another, or maybe complimentary idea of what the Boba Fett movie was going to be with Josh Trank. Do you remember that scoop that you had?
I'm not sure which one this is, but like, I remember way back in the day, I got a scoop about they were making spinoffs, and I reported that there was a Han Solo and a Boba Fett movie in the works. And then I had to wait. I mean, I knew it. I had it dead to rights, right? Or else I wouldn't have published it.
Yeah.
But then I had to wait like years for them to confirm there was a Han Solo movie. And, you know, Josh got bounced from the Boba Fett movie the day
at Celebration.
He was supposed to go.
Yeah.
Remember when they showed at Celebration that little clip of Rogue One?
Yes.
And it was like, you know,
that was so awkward.
The Death Star and the and he was supposed to show a little preview clip of the Boba Fett movie, and so I don't know if that's the one you saw, but then I also did some reporting on the you know, James Mangold taking on the Boba Fett movie, and then there was, you know, Josh Trank leaving, or not leaving, but the calamity of the Fantastic Four film, which, you know, had some details about the Boba Fett movie.
Well, one of the reports you did, the one that I read at least, was about this idea of like the film would explore Boba Fett and the other bounty hunters that we see, you know, Darth Vader talking to in the original trilogy.
That was I think that was part of the idea, was you would weave in these other. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of another example of a kind of movie like this where there are sort of like all sorts of other grifters or, you know, underworld figures that you have to navigate in order to get to your goal.
But I kind of
think they were.
I kind of
They have Bosk. Bosk is ageless. IG-88.
But I kind of like that this is a, so, you know, having Boba Fett show up would be interesting. Having Boba Fett show up with Fennec Shand like by his side, and they're like bonded partners now, is much more interesting to me. I think that's a really interesting duo.
I, I do too. Yeah. I mean, also, look, it's just a storytelling tradition or trope or whatever you want to call it, that you need a sidekick. You need a Dr. Watson for your genius or for your hero. Everybody needs a Robin, or else you're not explaining the story to anyone. So
yeah,
I like Fennec. The thing I think is cool about Boba Fett and Fennec is Boba Fett's a bounty hunter. Fennec is an assassin.
Yeah.
She's not bringing you back alive.
That's true. That's true.
So I think there's a nice little bit of tension there. She's a hit woman.
Yeah. That's a good point. All right. Let's talk about Boba Fett coming out of the Sarlacc pit. And another point that our producer Dave pointed out to me when we were talking about the prevalent theories of who might have rescued baby Grogu from the youngling class before Anakin Skywalker shows up. So basically we find out in The Jedi that Grogu was training with the other younglings on Coruscant when Order 66 went into effect and Anakin Skywalker famously killed a bunch of children. Grogu was whisked away and we don't know by whomst. And I was wondering what theories you had heard or had, and then if you don't mention the one that I heard, I will chime in with that.
Okay, so I haven't done too much reading on this, to be honest, of what the other theories are. But my feeling is it's one of two options, right? It's somebody we know or somebody we don't. And somebody we don't is an opportunity for a new kind of storytelling, right? If it's somebody we know, it's like, oh, okay, the world gets a little bit smaller and it's connected to this character or that character. I think I don't really know, but I'm trying to think who would have even been around at the temple,
right,
to rescue little Grogu. I mean, maybe it was Yoda himself, right?
So
wasn't he at the temple?
Yeah, he was a little busy, but he shows up after. Doesn't he show up with Obi-Wan? Or Obi-Wan shows up. Oh, sorry. Guys, we gotta rewatch Revenge of the Sith.
So much for my cred here, because apologize. I can't remember now.
But Yoda's pretty busy at the moment. When all of that is happening. I thought that my memory is that Yoda and Obi-Wan at the same time discover the, like, that they're both in the Not the Younglings scene. Mm-hmm. But I could be wrong. Do you want to hear...
Yeah, let's hear your theory.
Okay, it's not my theory. It's Dave's theory. And Dave, I think, got it from other people. And then I'm going to take you through a whole journey of this conversation. He goes, Mace Windu. I was like, dude, Mace Windu's dead. He's already out the window at that point. He's like, right, but everyone we've seen thrown out the window or down an air shaft or into a Sarlacc has come back. We didn't see his body hit anywhere. He's like, Palpatine came back, Boba Fett came back, Darth Maul came back. He's like, what is throwing someone down something mean in Star Wars? And I was like, oh no. So how do you feel about Samuel Jackson, aka Mace Windu, being the one to save baby Grogu?
Maybe. I mean, I think Sam would be like, he would use an expletive and he would say, yeah, hell yeah.
Right.
But he, I'm back. I kind of like it, you know. I think maybe it was like I was going to say maybe this is a little more obscure, but like in the seventh season of The Clone Wars, Ahsoka was living on the lower tiers of Coruscant, this metropolis planet,
mm-hmm.
Where the Jedi Temple is located. And she palled around with the Martez sisters who, you know, they didn't think much of the Jedi because they were living a hard life in the lower tiers. And I don't know. It'd be kind of neat if it was somebody we knew. Those two that'd be kind of a neat story. See them, you know, they hear there's trouble and they get up there somehow and rescue baby Yoda. But Mace Windu, that's an interesting theory. Maybe they did it together.
Apparently, like, I was sort of digging into it, and apparently, like, George Lucas and Samuel Jackson have previously said that they think Mace Windu is alive. And apparently there's some rumors that Sam Jackson could be in The Mandalorian. So, you know, I don't know. I personally kind of love that theory.
You must have lost him at some point then, right?
I guess. I mean... I don't know. Maybe, yeah, that's like Val Kilmer and Willow. Who knows? Oh, speaking of, by the way, I rewatched Willow last week. And if you're listening and you've never seen Willow, what have you been doing with your life? But now is your time to course correct. It's on Disney Plus, a favorite of my childhood. Willow starring Warwick Davis and Val Kilmer and Joanne Whalley and all that sort of stuff. Great, 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 great film. And I showed it to some people who had never seen it before and they loved it. So it's not just my childhood nostalgia talking. I like wept through it. It's a beautiful movie. Fantasy at its best. It's essentially The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I hadn't put those pieces together, but Willow is basically The Mandalorian, except you've got an adorable redheaded girl child instead of a little green baby. So,
which character is Mando? Would it be Willow himself?
Mando is like a combination of Willow and Mad Mardigan, I think.
Yeah.
Because I mean, something I did want to say that I liked about this season of The Mandalorian is I feel like we're getting more, like, I felt disconnected from The Mandalorian in season one. And maybe part of that was how often Pedro Pascal was like not actually in the suit. I know there's still plenty of doubling going on in this season, but I feel like we're getting so much more of his personality. And partially that's story-based in terms of his personality is growing and changing as he grows into his role as this father, right? We, like, this episode starts with him just, like, chuckling over playing force fetch with his baby, you know what I mean?
I love when he's like, yes! Yeah. And Grogu's like, ooh, like, did I upset you? And he's like, oh, I'm not mad. That's cool. Like,
yeah. So, you know, I feel like that's something that I really like is I feel, you know, Pedro Pascal can be so charming. And I felt like he had to be so stiff in season one. And so I like that we're getting a bit more of warmth and personality from him this season.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
So that, you know, that growth feels very Mad Mardigan in Willow to me. Mm-hmm. Whereas Willow is just a good dad from the start. And then, all right, so then let's talk about who we think Grogu might be signaling in this episode. You know, Ahsoka says, maybe if you take him to this temple on top of the hill, send out a signal into the galaxy, maybe another Jedi will see it and come train him because I, Ahsoka, do not feel up to the job. There are some theories floating around. What is your favorite? Who do you think is coming? Who do you want to have come? What do you think?
Luke Skywalker?
Okay, that's a common theory, yes. Some people think...
In the form of Sebastian...
Yeah, Sebastian Stan as Luke Skywalker, sure. I don't like that, by the way, because I like...
You don't like the replacement actor?
No, because, I mean, Sebastian can do whatever, but, like, I don't... And some of those side-by-side photos of Sebastian Stan and young Mark Hamill are uncanny. True.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that there's no Skywalker in this story.
Yeah.
And I would like to keep
I'm down
way.
With that.
You know what I mean?
I think that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, who else is left? There's Ahsoka. There's... yeah, there's Ahsoka and there's Luke.
I think the main theory outside of Luke is Ezra Bridger, who hasn't been mentioned by name in the show yet, but people who know Ezra, who is a character in Rebels in the animated series, know that he was last seen with Admiral Thrawn, and that's who Ahsoka's looking for is mm-hmm. Thrawn.
And she's
Ezra.
Clearly tracking. I think it's obvious she's tracking Thrawn to find
Ezra.
That's a good theory.
Though I just don't know, like, what's funny about what happened in this episode is, like, I thought the temple was going to be the season finale. And the season finale instead seems like, let's get a band together and go rescue the baby. Like, that's probably seems like where we're heading. And then maybe the final moment is a Jedi shows up. Right. And you're like, oh, shoot, so-and-so's here. But like for people who haven't seen Rebels, it's not going to be an, oh, shoot, Ezra Bridger, who I've never heard of, is here. You know what I mean? And so like maybe it is Luke. I don't know. But I feel like they're saving like an, oh, shoot, this Jedi is here. And are they going to bank on people doing their homework and being excited for Ezra? Or are they going to bank on people being addicted to the Skywalker saga and do Luke? I don't know. Or is it going to be a third option? Who knows? But
so he sends this beam up into the sky surrounded by blue butterflies, which also seems to be symbolic. I know that's a common symbol for Raylos online. what does the blue butterfly symbolize otherwise? Or is that just, is that it?
I don't know. Do you think Ben Solo's coming?
I mean,
just I don't know that that makes a lot of sense. But...
I don't think it makes a lot of sense. No.
I mean, like, the number one reason why I don't think it would be Ben Solo is
he would be a little kid.
He's eight. Well, yeah. Well, then you could get someone else to play him because I'm like, Adam Driver's like, I'm done. I'm pretty sure Adam Driver's done with Star Wars. Yeah, Luke, Ezra, baby Ben, maybe, could be. I wanted to talk about that blue beam into the sky moment because it reminded me a lot of one of my favorite shows of all time, Avatar. And occasionally the Avatar will go into something called the Avatar State, where they will sort of like leave their body. And there's like in the season one finale of Avatar and a couple other times, like basically his pals have to protect his body while he is gone. And that this reminded me of that a lot. Like the baby is so defenseless because he's like gone, basically. And Fennec and Boba and Din Djarin have to protect that body.
And Dave Filoni directed, that's how he started, was on The Last Airbender.
Last Airbender, yeah. Mm-hmm. So a very Avatar moment, I felt like, for okay. We're almost done. We've been yammering probably long enough. I just have a few other things that I want to say. One question we got repeatedly from people is that they felt like the sort of serialized quest of the week thing was wearing thin for them. Where does that sit with you?
I think so. I think they start to feel like little quests in a video game is the criticism I've seen. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, hey, if you help me get this, then you can have this and continue your journey. I'm not sure what you want there to be action, and I think that what they're going for is a little bit of resolution to every episode.
And you see him looping back, like it feels like the world is, you know, like having Fennec Shand show up. You don't have to introduce her; we know her. We find out at the end of this episode he's looking for Bill Burr's character, who we met in season one. Every time he goes back to Cara Dune, that's a familiar character, you know, stuff like that. So, like, we don't have to re-meet everyone every week anymore. When Amy Sedaris shows up this season, we already know who she is. So it's slowly populating this world with figures in a way that doesn't make it seem like they're sort of shaking the Etch-a-Sketch clean every week, like they were in season one. But I think a lot of my favorite shows, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Justified, like these shows started as extreme monster of the week, like almost procedural type stories, and then became something much richer. And so I think there's potential for the Mandalorian to do that. But I also think that Favreau and Filoni like the idea of giving us a very simple, you know, I keep
self-contained story each time.
Yeah, Saturday morning serial sort of thing. By serial, I mean S-E-R-I-A-L. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That has me thinking maybe the Jedi who shows up at the end is Dr. Mandible. He was really good at cards.
I love it. I love that.
Maybe he had the Force working.
Or maybe it's Frog Lady. Maybe she was a Jedi the whole time. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
I really want to see.
She put a tracking device inside Baby Yoda through one
of her eggs. I really want to see those frog people again. And then the other question we were asked a couple times, and I have been thinking about this, is like, because of the setup, because of the various characters we keep meeting along the way, it feels like almost any one of these episodes could be a launch pad for a spinoff series.
It does feel that
way. And
I'm
sure that that's, you know, very intentional on behalf of Lucasfilm, that is looking to build out their empire in a way that didn't work for them necessarily in the films the way that they had originally planned it to. So if you were to pick one Disney Plus show to create as a spinoff of this show, what do you, Anthony Breskin, what would you want to see?
If I were to create a spinoff of a character we've seen already. That's a really good question, and I don't have an easy answer, but my mind goes to Fennec Shand. You know, I'd like to
like
see
Fennec and Boba, or just Fennec?
More or less her. Mm-hmm. Like I think, you know, not just her, but I think that underworld that underworld element would be interesting. I'd like to see a Star Wars crime story. I'd like to see them start doing things with genre that right now there's the Star Wars genre and everything fits into that. But Marvel always, not that everybody has to imitate Marvel, but you know, they tell a Marvel story, but they make this one is like a paranoid 70s thriller.
Yeah.
And this one is like a 90s action movie.
Yeah.
You know, Captain Marvel is like a 90s action movie. And the Winter Soldier is like a paranoid 70s thriller.
Robert Redford's even here. Wow.
What's that?
I said Robert Redford's even here. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Right? yeah. Precisely. So I kind of think like right now what we have is like we have like the Western, like the Have Gun Will Travel.
Yeah.
I mean, he lives on, like outside the law a little bit, but he's still sort of a lawman in some ways. He's rounding up bad guys and he's doing the right thing. I mean, like, imagine a Sopranos style show. Like, it's just.
But they would never go that dark, you know, on Disney
Plus. They wouldn't go that dark. But, like, but this is a story about the bad guys. And you empathize with them, but they're bad guys.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to leech off of the New Republic and steal ships and, like, run heists and commit crimes, you know, family friendly crimes in the Star Wars universe. But where you have this assassin as the lead character, and she's super charismatic and she doesn't wear a mask all the time, so we can have her, you know, making her way through the underbelly of the galaxy would be kind of fun. You know, she'd be given these tasks to take people out and you know, assassinate a hut here, take out Dr. Mandible there. It'll be great.
Currently, we have the Obi-Wan series coming and the Cassian Andor series coming, right?
Yeah. And I think I would place good money on an Ahsoka series.
Right. That seems
not
like
based on any inside information.
No.
But just like
yeah.
my sense of it is like they're. They like that character, and people like that character.
Dave Filoni loves, like, Dave Filoni talks about that character like she's his daughter. Like,
he does.
Like, I would agree with you. If I were to pick a character.
Yeah, let's hear yours.
I mean, what's tough is, like, I like your pitch that, like, it should be a different genre. I don't have a good answer for that, because what I really just want is more Cobb Vanth. But that's just more Western. So, I don't know, but I'm a big Cobb Vanth fan, so I would love to see him do something. And as we know, since he's done it twice already, Timothy Olyphant can hold down a gunslinging show. So, I don't know. You know, Space Marshal?
Space Marshal would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Anyway, if folks have other ideas, we're going to do one more of these, as I said, for season two. If you have a spinoff idea, if you're like, oh, we got to go back to the Sanctuary, or like, oh, you know, Cara Dune, I want that, or anything like that, please email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. By the way, if you're listening to this and you're like, why haven't Joanna and Anthony mentioned the various real world sort of, I don't want to say the word scandal, the conversations we're having.
Controversy
is the word. Around two of the actresses who are on The Mandalorian this season. We have written about them this kind of extensively over at VF.com. So if you want our take on that, you can go read that. We've sort of, not that the conversation's over, it's just like, I think that's the best, rather than just talk extemporaneously in a podcast, that's our best, most well-researched take on this question.
We address it in the Rosario interview as well, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
And I want people to know that, you know, Joanna and I, is it okay to say we're doing our best to make sure that all perspectives in this fandom get represented and,
yeah.
and that the questions that you want to have asked are asked.
Yeah.
That's important to us.
Absolutely. All right. Is there anything else Mandalorian season two that we want to talk about? Or Mandalorian in general. So this season, like last season, is largely credited as written by Jon Favreau. The exception being last week's episode, The Jedi, was written by Dave Filoni, or credited, you know, it's complicated in TV crediting, but like credited to Dave Filoni. And next week's, according to Wikipedia at least, is credited to Rick Famuyiwa, who's also directing. And he did one of the episodes. Well, he directed two of the episodes, but wrote one of the episodes in season one as well. So do you have any expectations about what Rick, you know, might be up to?
He's one of my favorite directors in this show. Mm-hmm. And so he did the heist episode.
Right. So,
and I believe he did okay, so if they're going after Bill Burr's character, that's right up his alley.
Yeah.
And I believe he did the second episode as well, or was that Deborah Chow?
No, he did the second episode.
She did the third one.
Yeah.
He's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And his love of this genre and this universe, it just comes radiating through. He's a fantastic director and great with action. So let's see. I'm down for it. I'm excited to hear
that. If we're doing another sort of like prison heist, or do we need to like boost Bill Burr out of prison this time or whatever? Rick's your guy, I guess. So here we go. Back into the heist for the penultimate episode. And then is there anything we want to say about like Moff Gideon and the cloning and the trauma of them? I don't know if you saw. Okay, so you were like, what's the tragedy? And I'm like, taking the child is the tragedy of this episode. But like, I don't know if you saw the you know how they do, of course, you know, they do the concept art over the end credits. The shot, the concept art shot of them, of the Dark Troopers taking the baby. And the baby's face was way worse in concept art than it was in execution. The baby just looks so upset and traumatized. And, like, of course, the baby is still upset. And we see the baby throw some stormtroopers around upset.
He's mad.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's Grogu handling those stormtroopers, like, banging them around the cell. And I thought it was a little scary when Moff Gideon ignites that darksaber and gets it a little close to the kid. You know,
I thought
that's not cool.
That was one of my favorite Giancarlo Esposito acting in the series so far, though. Like Giancarlo acting opposite that puppet is some really good stuff.
Yeah,
really menacing, but really like cutesy at the same time. Makes you so sleepy.
Oh no, you don't get to touch this. Just
and then they shot the baby and put it in little baby shackles. Like that's. That's the thing about this episode. Like, once again, I agree with you. I feel like it's kind of a mixed bag because I do think that like shootout took up way too much of the episode, but like, for the old school diehard fans who are like, finally my Boba Fett moment, I'm having it. I finally get it. For folks who are maybe newer fans or just sort of latching to the Mandalorian or whatever, you also have this very like primal story of this baby separated from this dad who loves him, and you're very concerned for the baby. So there's just like, there's a fundamental story here that you can understand, even if you have no context about caring about whether or not Boba Fett gets back in his armor or not. You know what I mean? So
yeah, for sure. There's a humane element to it.
Yeah.
And also lots of nostalgia. You mentioned the Dark Troopers. That's one thing we didn't address. That's from a 90s era video game called Dark Forces, you know? And it's again,
there's been a lot of video game stuff.
A lot of video game stuff.
I've played zero video games. There's a lot of video game references in this, which is, you know, fun. Yeah, I mean, to circle back one last thing before we go, if that's okay, to this sort of like...
We're like Star Wars Columbo here. One last thing.
In terms of the story of the week, I don't know. Did you see that viral video that's going around? A couple people sent it to me about this is the plot of every episode of The Mandalorian. It's like a guy and his dog. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's very short. And it's just sort of like, I mean, I don't want to describe a video to you, but it's like basically it's a guy, his dog, he put like a filter on his dog so his dog looks green. And he like shows up to a new planet and they're like, he's like, I need that milk for my baby. And the guy on the planet's like, you need to kill our monster / warlord / whatever. And then we'll give you the milk. And Mando goes, okay. And then he does it. And then he comes back and he goes, milk, please. Oh, oops. Baby Yoda already drank it. The end. Like, and I was like, and he's like, that's every episode of The Mandalorian. I was like, I mean, I can't argue, honestly, with that.
Wildly entertaining every time.
Yeah, but the best version of that. And like, it just feels like really low stakes television to me. Once again, maybe because I usually watch it at either midnight or like way early in the morning. And so I'm just sort of like, it's Star Wars. I don't know. I'm happy enough to be in a Star Wars world. Could it be more? Probably. But is it enough for me right now in December 2020? Yes, it is sparking joy for me. So that's where I am. All right. Anthony Breskin, until you come back in a couple weeks to talk about hopefully the rescue of baby Grogu, where can folks find your work?
You can find me on vanityfair.com. Obviously.
And on Twitter?
That's where it is. Sure. I'm on Twitter at Breznican.
At Breznican. All right. You can find me on vanityfair.com as well. Follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. We will be back with one more episode of The Mandalorian, and Richard and I are doing one last episode of The Flight Attendant, and then that will be it for 2020, and we will see you and baby Grogu, safe and sound. I'm going to manifest that into the world in a couple weeks. Bye.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.